Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today, it's the differences between the Austrian and Chicago School of Economics. Plus, what's the difference between Keynesian economics and neo-Keynesian economics? And how neoclassic economists managed to throw their ideas out the window. Plus, Brexit. Is it a Russian plot? And WTO rules. Are they as bad as Europe's? And if that sounds like a grab bag of questions, well, that's because it is. They've been sent in by a listener. Maybe it could be yours next time. It's the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Okay, so Steve, I like this idea actually, and we should open this up to subscribers so that they can, you know, so they can ask questions. So Sunil Basu has written and has got a whole heap of questions. So I think Ask Steve Anything should be something that we do periodically, and you know, throw out those questions, things that you're not sure about. And I'm glad because he's asked some questions that, you know, I'd like to ask as well. Now, Sunil Basu, by the way, I'm not sure if it's the same Sunil Basu who's on Twitter, which means he's the Green Party candidate for Western Supermare. I suspect it is, given the questions he's asked. He only got 3.3% of the votes, I have to say. It's a big Tory area, and John Penrose is the MP there, married to Baroness Harding, who set up Test and Trace. Not that there's any nepotism going on in the Tory party, of course, whatsoever. And what a terrific job she's doing of Test and Trace in the UK. Now, look, he says, so Sunil's question, and there's a few of them, I'm trying hard to understand as much as I can. So here's a few requests for my enlightenment. What was wrong with Keynes's idea? What's the difference between Keynesian and post-Keynesian? And how did the neoliberals manage to take over the whole idea? So, well, let's start with Keynes's idea. I mean, the big one, obviously, which is, you know, which is really relevant right now. And I think when people think of Keynesian economics, they think of using public money to try and bail us out of a downturn. So, and that's why people are talking Keynes at the moment.
That's partly it, and that's certainly what Keynes was arguing. But he began from a perspective of saying that the capitalist economy can't be guaranteed to provide full employment. And the basis of that was talking about the instability of investment. And what he said there, and this is the, if you want to get a head, pardon me. If you want to get a handle on Keynes without having to read the general theory, and in fact, I think you can do it better without reading the general theory than with reading the general theory, read a paper which I think is easily to find on the web called The General Theory of Employment. It's 24 pages long. It was written in 1937, 1 year after the general theory, and Keynes summarized his ideas in that 24 pages. And what had happened between when he wrote the general theory and that summary, he really coalesced about what was new in his approach rather than what was going on with the general theory of employment, interest, and money itself, the book.
Okay, well, you summarize that 24 pages in 1 minute then. Why can't we have full employment? Why can't the economy provide for full employment?
Because of the instability of investment, and because total demand is the sum of consumption demand and investment demand. Consumption demand is fairly stable because it depends upon current needs. Investment demand is highly unstable because that depends upon people's expectations of future profit, a future about which we know so little, to quote Keynes. So therefore, right, you get an enormous volatility out of the investment side. And Keynes didn't do enough to elaborate the role of the financial sector there. That was one of his failings, he admitted to in 37 as well. But that's the basic idea, focusing upon the uncertainty of the future, affecting people's willingness to invest, and therefore the sum of aggregate demand will be highly volatile, unstable. And in that case, there's a role for the government to step in.
Okay, makes perfect sense. So what's the difference then between that, if that is Keynesian economics, and post-Keynesian economics?
Well, let's go back to what people actually think is Keynes, because it's not Keynes at all. It's neoclassical. And this right, is something which, again, you have to read the history of economic thought, which I've done in painful detail, and to understand what actually happened. But there was Keynes's book, was, if you, when you think when it came out, there was a state of pretty much complete despair amongst economists globally, particularly in America, because they, first of all, didn't see the Great Depression coming. They all thought 1930 was going to be a fabulous year, much the same as the mistakes they made in 2007. Secondly, there was a serious decline in the economy, of course, from the beginning of the crisis to its peak. Unemployment in America rose from the, when they were using how many people are registered for the dole, fundamentally registered as unemployed, went from statistically 0% to 26% between October 1929 and I think about June 1932. Then it turned around and it fell down to 11%. And over that period, you can see the people getting more and more confident. And in particular, Americans have got a disease of confidence, as we've all, I hope, realized. And they started, American economic advisors thought, it's all behind us. The exogenous shock, whatever it was, is gone. We can now get back to responsible budgeting. And we're going to tell Roosevelt to cut this stupid budget deficit and balance the books of the government, which the government proceeded to do. And unemployment rose from 11% to 20% again. Now, that was just before Keynes' book arrived in America. So you think at that point, the neoclassicals, which is what they were in total despair. What the hell is going on? We don't know. Well, here comes a book which can save us, hence the status Keynes' book got. But they didn't understand it. It was completely outside their way of thinking. There was stuff inside there which was familiar, and that's what they grabbed onto. There was stuff which is completely unfamiliar, and it caused quite a bit of what the hell do we do next confusion. It's a bit like telling a Ptolemaic astronomer, to do your epicycles with the sun at the center rather than the earth. They just don't know what it means.
But you said that Keynes was a neoliberal in his approach. That seems to be what you were saying.
No, he's not.
I was going to say. I mean, he's the complete opposite, isn't he? So,
Keynes was not. He's a complicated character. I describe him as being a bit like watching a snake shedding skin or a caterpillar turning into a butterfly and you caught him halfway. It's a mess, okay? And you've got this stuff in Keynes where there's a lot of stuff which is Marshallian and a lot of stuff about marginal analysis as well, combined with stuff which is completely contradictory with that. So that's where there was a melange, and you could look at Keynes' stuff and justifiably make a case, as Krugman does on quite a few occasions, for a very neoclassical interpretation of Keynes. But what actually happened was Hicks, who was sort of his rival, one of his rivals at a different university, wrote a paper called Wages and Profit, the Dynamic Problem, in 1935. And what he was trying to do in that paper was to build a time-based sequential model of the economy. And he had an economy which just produced bread as an output, and it had two inputs, or two classes of inputs, bread itself and then machinery. And he was going to build a model which, if he'd done it, would have been a complete tour de force. Instead, it turned into a tour de farce, because what he said was that there were two types of bread being produced, bread you ate today and bread you didn't eat today, which became capital the next day. Now, I don't know how often you've tried to make a bread kiln out of stale bread, but if you succeed, please let me know. I'll put you in the Guinness Book of Records.
It'd be a curious thing to say.
Impossible. Okay. So, but in the middle of all that, what he was dealing, and Hicks explained all this in 1981, 82, in a paper which unfortunately was published in a post-Keynesian journal, meaning no neoclassical read it. But what he did in the middle of that was he's trying to toy with the idea of how do you handle a three-market model of the economy. So you've got money, you've got goods and services, and you've got employment. And he said, if you take the Walrasian, and this is why it becomes totally neoclassical, Walras' model of capitalism talked about having multiple markets for multiple commodities and trying to reach an equilibrium across all those markets at once. And the rule was, and this is just a mathematical logic, if you achieved equilibrium in N minus one markets, where N is a number of markets, then the nth market also had to be in equilibrium. Okay? So you could drop one of your market, you choose to drop one of your markets or choose that particular market's output as your numerator for the entire economy. So in that thinking, this is what Hicks wrote in the 35 paper, as an aside effectively in trying to build this sketch of a model, which he never really finished. He said, if you have X market and Y market in equilibrium, then you can ignore Z market. So you can have a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional model. And that's what the ISLM model is, because
this is why we get all those demand and supply graphs that we're taught in, you know, sixth form level economics.
Well, what actually happened was the supply and demand stuff was all micro, and that was what was Marshall's responsibility, irresponsibility. Hicks found a way to convert that across to macro, where the IS and the LM curves respectively became like the demand curve and the supply curve. And that meant that rather than facing this really unfamiliar Keynesian stuff about expectations, uncertainty in the future, it's supply and demand. And the only thing which Hicks did that made the model at all interesting was to curve one of the lines. So rather than being a straight line, it was pretty vertical at the far end of the axis when you had high employment and pretty horizontal at the other. And what he then said was, if the demand curve, that was the supply curve, effectively had this sort of upside down, L lying on its back type shape. And he said, and the demand curve was the thing which the government could control by changing the money supply. And what he said was, if you're in the lying down on the ground part of the L curve and you increase the demand, then you have no impact upon price level. The price is the vertical axis, or the interest rate is the vertical axis. So you can move when you're in this lying on its back stage. If you increase demand by government action, you can increase employment without changing the interest rate. So that's what he called the Keynesian region. And then once you get to the straight up section of the L curve pointing vertically, at that point you're in the neoclassical world, where if you try to boost demand by boosting government spending, you'll just make the interest rate go up and you'll have crowded out of public, private spending
because,
by public.
Because you're adjusting the equilibrium. So, I mean, that's the fundamental difference then, isn't it? I mean, Hicks is there saying...
It's equilibrium thinking.
Equilibrium thinking, and Keynes was saying, no, there's no such thing as equilibrium, which is why the government needs to step in when confidence is falling, so there's not investment happening.
So
what's the difference then between Keynesian and post-Keynesian then?
Well, first of all, post-Keynesian takes on the expectations, the importance of an uncertain future, determining how much investment you want to undertake. So what Hicks ignored was that investment is fundamentally a function of expectations about the future for Keynes. He made it a function of the rate of interest. So that's... And that, when you make it the function of the rate of interest, you can fine tune the economy. You know, just if there's not enough investment, drop the interest rate. That'll make more projects have a positive net present value. That'll boost investment, and you're back in a well functioning economy again. And that's the fine tuning fantasy that took over the neoclassicals from the 50s and 60s. So that's the distortion that Hicks did. Now, what the post Keynes said is, look, Keynes was talking about uncertain expectations, volatility, and even when it came to price levels, rather than having a single idea of a price level, Keynes had an idea of two price levels. And this became an important part of Keynesian analysis. So you would argue that Keynes said that there are goods, the standard consumption goods you and I buy, he was willing to say that was determined by supply and demand pricing. But he said the price of investment goods, the price you're willing to pay to buy a factory, depends upon your expectations of the future sales of that factory. So the determinant there is not the cost anymore, it's your expectations of the future. And if you have a euphoric expectations about the future, you'll pay hand over fist to buy that coastal five-star hotel or whatever else you're considering as an investment purchase. So and he then said that what actually motivates investment is a gap between the sale price of the of commodities, which tends to be a cost plus thing, and the cost of buying the investment goods, which is based on your future expectations. And that gives you enormous volatility. It leads into a role for the finance sector. It leads to Hyman-Minsky, those sorts of analyses. And that became post-Keynesian economics.
For example, just before the dot-com bomb, all those dot-com companies that were buying really expensive properties because they thought, yeah, we, you know, good times are here, so let's have the smartest offices right in the centre of town, even though they were still startups. And that ludicrous thinking was built on that expectation that things were going to be good so we can spend big.
That's right. And of course, in the point, I mean, not a lot of post-Keynesians acknowledge this, but a large part of what happened as well in post-Keynesian was bringing in ideas from other people like Irving Fisher. And Irving Fisher had the debt deflation theory of Great Depressions as his own independent, and I think, frankly, better explanation of the Great Depression than Keynes's explanation. So with that blending, you got this time for finance. When you look at Minsky, for example, Minsky's early references make no reference to Keynes. He only read Keynes by accident when he had to referee somebody's paper, and he read the 1937 paper, and it stunned him how different that was from what he was told in the textbooks. And that was the beginning of him developing his alternative analysis, the financial instability hypothesis. And then you had Schraffer, who was Piero Schraffer was a genius Italian, rather reclusive, mathematically oriented but not mathematically trained logician. And he developed a range of logical critiques of neoclassical economics before Keynes was even willing to countenance them. So in 26, Schraffer published a paper of the law of returns under competitive conditions, which established logically that most firms should face constant or falling marginal cost, and therefore your cost system had to be different to what Marshall was arguing for. Keynes couldn't bring himself to swallow that stuff. But when you look at how the post-Keynesians came together, all these ideas got blended. And the overall label of Keynes is, to a substantial degree, more the popularity and awareness people have of Keynes than what they have of Schraffer or Fisher.
So why, though, was Keynes in the mainstream? Why was he accepted? I guess it's because we're facing a recession, a depression. So, as you said, you know, people looked for anything to get him out of it.
Yeah.
But why did that idea go away? Was that simply because the neoliberals thought, well, no, we can... You know, we don't need fiscal stimulus. We don't need money pushed from the government. We can do all of this through monetarist means.
That took longer. I mean, if you go back to the early 50s,
you're talking about how it's all a factor of the interest rate is balancing things out, which is
But you also had an early belief that you had to have fiscal policy, because when you drew the ISLM model, the liquidity money thing was the equivalent of the supply curve, and that was the kinky one. The one they draw as a sort of downward sloping straight line was the IS curve, and that's related to the demand curve. And then the argument is you could boost that by government spending. If there was too low a level of demand, you feel yourself in what Hicks called the Keynesian region of the diagram, where boosting demand by extra government spending did not increase the interest rate and therefore didn't crowd out the private sector. So the theory, the early stuff, which was the main popularizer of this, wasn't Hicks, it was Samuelson. But with this analysis, also what's called the aggregate supply, aggregate demand analysis, it all argued in favor of fiscal policy. Now, the shift to get rid of that began under Friedman, but that's where you got the true, absolutely purist neoclassical stuff coming back in again. And the way that Friedman portrayed the idea of the government trying to modify the level of demand to increase employment was as if the economy is already at equilibrium with full employment, and the government's trying to drive the employment level even higher. And then that, of course, really basically assumes, you know, the Keynesian region doesn't exist, or we're not there anyway, and the government's trying to push the economy to a higher level of performance than it would actually reach at equilibrium, rather than getting it from below to within reach of equilibrium. So it was a long and steady demolition process, and what it really involved was going back to micro, and that's the stuff that you didn't find much of in Keynes. I don't think you should find any of it in economics, but that's what took over economics and got us back to where we are now.
No, you should use it if you're running a company, but that's about it. But imagine you are...
Run a company into the ground if you follow neoclassical micro. It's bullshit. Sorry.
Imagine you are Milton Friedman then. Just for a second. Put yourself in his shoes and explain to me, as he would, why Britain went through years of austerity. This belief that you need to feel the hurt to get an economy to recover. So you need to cut government spending, and you need to cut debt and get the books back into balance. I mean, even Rishi Sunak now is, you know, even though we're going through this global pandemic, you know, you've got the UK Chancellor talking about balancing the books. Explain to me why they see that as being so important.
Okay, that comes out of the expectation that Friedman developed for inflation. And this is the famous helicopter paper model. And the one thing that he did of any merit, in my opinion, is legitimizing, he'll use the word helicopter money, but apart from that, nothing. But that was his model of the idea of a government controlling the money supply is something outside the economy. So this helicopter flying over this mythical country is the government creating money. And what he argued was that if you have 1,000 $1 notes in the economy, and it's running at long-run general equilibrium, so everybody wants a job has got a job at the going wage rate, all goods and services, original supply equals demand in all markets, and everybody is doing their shopping using these pieces of paper marked this is $1, and they carry a certain amount of that money in their pockets, and by carrying their pockets, they're actually incurring a loss because they'd be better off, in one sense, spending it, but they've got to keep like 1/12 of it for consumption. So there's a utility loss in hanging onto the money rather than spending it. So what he then said is, if the helicopter flies over and drops another 1,000 notes out of the helicopter, then that will cause everybody, first of all, to think, oh, it's twice as much demand as I thought there was. I've got to produce more, hire more workers, blah, blah, blah. And workers' demand wage rises, yada, yada, yada. And what you finally get is you get an initial boost in demand out of the money dropping. And then as people go through all the utility and cost adjustments involved, ultimately you double the price level. And you get back to exactly the same equilibrium again. So that's his one-off. And then what he said is, imagine a continuous stream of helicopters doing this. Then what would people come to expect these helicopters to be dropping money out of the sky? And therefore, if they're dipping it at such a rate that the money supply is growing by 10% per annum, people come to expect inflation of 10% per annum every year. And because of that, they put their prices up by 10% every year without even being involved in any sale it's just expectations.
So the converse argument to that then is, if you don't fly those helicopters and you're actually pulling money out of the economy, then you would expect that inflation is going to go down. You keep inflation under control, which would be the
reason. And that was the advice. So having had this period of too many helicopters, you turn on the furnaces instead and destroy the money and reduce the expectations over time. And by the
way, isn't it? Because if that's the argument, I don't remember seeing runaway inflation in the last decade. Well, austerity has been.
No, the last four decades. Yeah. I mean, the neoclassicals, not that they are going to fight the last war. There's only one war they want to fight, and that's against inflation, because that's the price system out of control. We can blame that on the government. It's all the government's fault, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. So, look, there are a lot of people, though, still saying, Keynes doesn't, even now, when we've all accepted the government has had to step in because this money is not going to come from anywhere else. So The Spectator, I'm looking back at this is a few years ago, but James Bartholomew, a prominent writer in The Spectator in 2016, pointing out, his argument is Keynesian economics just doesn't work. During the Clinton presidency, spending was cut on both defense and welfare. According to the Keynesians, the cutting of the structural budget deficit should have depressed the economy, but the very opposite happened. It boomed. Output moved from being 3% below the trend to 1.5% above. And in late 2012, Keynesians got very distressed about the fiscal cliff. This was the moment when taxes were increased and the government spending reduced. Keynesians foresaw doom and gloom. Instead, growth accelerated in the following year. And that we hear that argument, don't we? The opposite, which is what we've just been talking about, that, if you have austerity, you're going to get somehow, miraculously, although no one's actually explained why to me very well, you are going to get growth coming through, other than that inflation argument. Is there anything else other than that inflation argument which would say, cut back on government spending, have a smaller government, good times around the corner.
Oh, this is a massive stuff, and so long as you're willing to blow your brains out, it makes perfect sense. Things like what's called Ricardian equivalence, invented by a guy called Robert Barrow, and this says that he actually made the argument that the government must maintain a balance, balance budget over the infinite horizon. So if you have a deficit now, that must be followed by a surplus in the future, and therefore if you run a deficit now, private individuals who know this, of course, this is the idea of knowledge of the future is an essential part of neoclassical thinking, though they won't bloody well admit it unless they slip up. And I've had a couple of slip-ups, like happy to mention them, including the author of the slip-up. But anyway, this idea that you know that the future, if there's a deficit now, there's got to be a surplus in the future. So you save money out of your private to be able to pay those future taxes. Now, people came back and said, I mean, anybody swallowing, so this should be a point to say, excuse me, mate, the padded cells are that way. You're in the wrong building. But instead, they take this crap seriously. And then someone says, oh, yes, but what about if people expect those taxes to be levied after they've died? Well, this is where the idea of Ricardian equivalence comes in, because Barrow then says, this argument will fail. And this is classic. I mean, I love this because it's so fucking stupid. Pardon any young kids listening there. He said that if... Maybe the argument that the people will not save because they expect the taxes to be levied after their lifetime fails if people are currently giving to future generations through, and wait for this word, altruism. Can you imagine neoclassical economists using altruism as an argument to undermine a critique of neoclassical economics? That's exactly what he did. Altruistically, they're putting aside money so that their great-great-grandchildren can pay the taxes they expect to be levied in 500 years' time. That is such total garbage, but that's the sort of thing he's used to.
But you hear it a great deal from neoclassic economists that, you know, we, for example, if we're spending up big now, then this will all have to be paid for by our grandkids. Therefore, what we're doing now is bad for future generations. So they are using the altruistic argument all the time.
Oh, we're worried about our grandkids so much. Yeah. Not our grandparents, of course. They can die in a nail home with COVID. But yeah, we're worried about our grandkids.
All right. Sorry. Okay. The difference. Another question comes. The difference between the Austrian and Chicago schools. Well, the Chicago school is very much free market economics, isn't it? You know, the best allocation of resources and all that. Pretty much what we've been talking about. So how does the Austrian school differ from that?
Well, the fundamental things differ with it. They've got exactly the same theory of values. They start from marginal utility for the consumer, marginal cost for the producer. They envisage rising marginal cost and falling marginal utility and all the balancing effects of the market economy. But they make the point, and there are some valid points in the Austrians, that markets are not in equilibrium. In fact, the advantage for entrepreneurs, and this is a character that plays a far larger role in Austrian thinking than neoclassical thinking. The role for an entrepreneur is to perceive that there is an advantage to be exploited between a gap between what the market is currently providing and what people need, or a point where there's going greater supply than demand for some products, or less supply than demand for others, and to take advantage of that and make a profit. And actually, in some ways, even though
this is like utility, the utility value, isn't it? Really?
But what's going on is they're saying there's a disequilibrium. And the exploitation of the disequilibrium is what enables the system to progress. And that's not a bad way. That's a reasonable piece of logic in its own right.
But doesn't a lot of that gets down to this idea of utility, though, that what I see something being worth is different to what you see as something being worth. And therefore, if I'm putting a greater value on something, then that's an opportunity for you to exploit. If I'm stupid enough to buy a new phone, for example, that folds out in a different way, then, and I'm prepared to pay twice as much than you are for that, and it cost the same amount to produce as a normal phone, that's an opportunity.
That's the sort of thing, yeah. But it's, I mean, the best person, even though he's not strictly an Austrian, he is Austrian by birth and Austrian by economic analysis, is Joseph Schumpeter. And if anybody who's serious in economics hasn't read it yet, I highly recommend reading Schumpeter's Theory of Economic Development. It's a very readable book. It's only 150 pages, I think. And he explains how you can, in the what he sees as the Walrasian vision, the neoclassical, and that's Chicago school fundamentally, vision of a system in equilibrium. He then says in that world, there's no profit. Okay. If you imagine yourself having to pay wages, the actual marginal cost of wages to buy higher workers and the marginal cost of capital to rent machinery, then if you're in equilibrium, those two are equal to the revenue you get and there's no profit. So he said, how do you create a profit? There has to be a disequilibrium. And he goes through six different instances where there's a disequilibrium you can exploit. Now, one, of course, is productivity change. So he gives the example of if you invent a machine that enables one worker to produce the output of six, and that's the case like with the original spinning jenny, then so long as the machine itself and its maintenance and parts and energy costs are less than five times the cost of a worker, then you can make a profit and make an advantage. And that's a discontinuous change. So that's the sophisticated side of the Austrians. The simplistic side is they've got basically a gold vision of money. And they blame fractional reserve banking for all the economic woes, which would be really, really terrible, really, really great idea if fractional reserve banking actually existed.
Since we don't have the gold standard, does that mean that schools like the Austrian school are just worthless now because none of it applies?
Well, on that front, they've got no clue about money. Apart from
not having a clue about money, they've got economics nailed. Is that what we're saying?
What have the Austrians done for us? Yeah. There is some merit. They focus more upon uncertainty, and there's people like Shackle, who's sort of on the border of Austria, and who's done a lot of good work about what uncertainty actually means versus risk. So there's some useful contributions in some of the Austrians, but they still believe we're very close to equilibrium, and they have no idea of the accumulation of debt.
Right.
And that's one thing that leaves them out of.
So a two sentence answer then, the difference between
the
Austrian
two sentences.
Schools. Yeah, that's right. They can be. I know, but your sentence is gone forever, of course. It's like when you're talking about an economics textbook, you say it's only 150 pages. I was thinking at the time, that's like 10,000 pages in normal books. The different two-sentence answers to the difference between the Austrian school and the Chicago school.
Okay. Austrians emphasize equilibrium doesn't apply. It's an ideal which never occurs. So that gives you an opportunity for profit. And they focus upon uncertainty in a way that the Chicago school ignores.
Right, and the Chicago school is very much about equilibrium. This is Milton, Milton Friedman's heartland, isn't it, basically?
Indeed, yeah.
So all of that is the idea of, you know, limiting the value of money, control of the value of money, supply of money is determining the value of money and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so the other questions he's asking which is just, we'll get through these quickly.
Yeah, sure, okay.
Nothing to do with the hard economic theory we've been going through, and we're running out of time. Brexit. Do you think the hard Brexit program? I know your answer to this one, probably. Do you think the hard Brexit program is sponsored by oligarchs hoping to avoid EU taxation rules affecting the City of London? So this is the fact that we know Russians and Ukrainians have been buying up London property for some time. You know, hoping that those assets are going to be hidden from international sanctions. I think before you have a go at this, the answer is well, maybe, but probably not, because you know the EU has supposedly been freezing and confiscating assets that have been obtained through crime since 2014. And it's clearly not working, because London would have been included in that. So I don't know whether the EU is intending to ramp it up any more, but it seems unlikely, doesn't it?
I think it's probably also true that you've got more money laundering and blind eye stuff in London than you have in Europe. Okay. Except in Switzerland, the old gnomes of Switzerland. So there's probably fraud is a better business plan in the UK than it is in Europe, but not much better.
Yeah, and it's not going to change whether we're in or out of the EU. Well, there was that Russia report, wasn't there, with the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee put together, and it didn't want to be released. Boris Johnson tried to stop it being deleted. It was delayed by about 9 months. Mm. And it just said yes. It was a possibility that when it came to the Brexit vote, Moscow-based information operations might have influenced it through social media and perhaps through Sputnik and RT and places like that. Our friend, who's a Brexiteer, George Galloway on RT.
Ah, yes, George.
But, yeah, I don't know. Not a significant factor. Mm. Okay, his other question. Naomi Klein's, I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She wrote a book, This Changes Everything, which is largely about climate change, mm-hmm. actually. It's subtitled Capitalism Versus the Climate. So there, I've read the front page in full. That's all I've read of her book. But he says, she describes how the World Trade Organization prevents countries from subsidizing investments. Even after a no-deal Brexit, won't Britain be controlled by these regulations that are happening underneath EU competition rules? I think the answer to that is you betcha, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is one of the main shifts which has occurred in trade negotiations over the last 30 or 40 years. Corporations, first of all, given the same rights as human beings. So you can offend, blaspheme against a corporation, but it's something similar. And they can actually say that they can campaign against a government regulation if it jeopardizes their business model. For example, yep. if you
and
put up
a we've seen it with Airbus and we've seen it with Boeing.
So yeah, and cigarettes too, frankly. So, it's an appalling bloody thing. It constrains government behaviour. But, of course, this is all a part of the new neoliberal agenda. The less government does, the better. So if corporations stop governments passing rules that affect corporations, great. So, we'd still have a couple of those restrictions in there. One thing I'd love to see wound back.
What I loved was the fact that the World Trade Organization ruled that the EU had broken the rules by subsidising Airbus. And so the US could impose tariffs in retaliation on EU goods in response to that. And then the EU said, hang on a second, you're subsidizing Boeing. And the World Trade Organization said, oh, yeah, they are too. So you can impose tariffs against the US in retaliation for the subsidies that they're giving. So it's all a bit of a nonsense, isn't it?
It is a nonsense.
But they've got quite intricate rules on it all. And it's very similar. I mean, his point, once we... And we argued, we had that discussion a few weeks back about whether, because it's holding up the getting a Brexit deal, this idea of the level playing field. And I think he's right to point out, but it applies anyway with the World Trade Organization. And in fact, in the World Trade Organization, it's almost exactly the same regulations as sit within the EU. And that, you can't.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't subsidize industries if it's going to disadvantage another industry or another company. So
in another country,
in another country. So uniformly low corporate tax is okay, but lowering it for a select set of companies is not permissible. But you can do it if it's there to correct regional imbalances or provide seed funding for early stage technologies. So, but then you don't have old stage company technologies saying, well, they're subsidizing early stage technologies and that's stopping us from sweating our assets for as long as we want. So all of this goes to a WTO board that determines the outcome through all of this, which is a bit like the European courts. It's exactly the same. So we're leaving the EU to be part of a trade body that actually behaves in exactly the same way.
Potentially, yeah.
Nothing achieved. All right, very good. Well, there we are. Hmm. Let's ask Steve.
We should do more of those.
Yeah, it was
too.
Good, wasn't it? I enjoyed that. So thank you, Sunil Basu, for that. And if you've got other questions like that, for maybe four or five questions, which we can nut our way through in half an hour or so, then send them in. Good to talk, Steve. Catch you soon.
Welcome. Okay, good.
And next time, Michael Hudson is going to join us, and we're going to ask the question, is the time right now for a debt jubilee? Everyone in the world is racked in debt, worse than it was a year ago. Is this the time we just write it all off? That's next time on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. See you next week.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.